Hello, I'm Ralph Begleiter in Washington, D.C. For millions around the world, and especially in Europe and the United States, the Berlin Wall is an enduring symbol, despite the fact that it's been gone now for 20 years. Today, almost every trace of the wall itself has been erased in Berlin, replaced by modern buildings and new streetscapes. Deutsche Welle has recreated the wall as it was at the height of its existence in an exclusive animation. The wall is a symbol of the worst kind of political division imposed by leaders in Soviet Russia to keep their people from fleeing oppression, to prevent them from simply picking up their lives and moving out to the democracies of Western Europe and beyond.
For three decades in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the wall blocked any such movement. It was a monument to suppression of freedom. Its elaborate double wall system, complete with tank traps, electrified barbed wire fences, guard posts, and bright nighttime lighting, was portrayed as intended to keep out a U.S. and Allied invasion. But today, even the Russians admit the wall was more about keeping East Europeans in than keeping anyone out. The wall extended far beyond Berlin, cruelly cutting Germany's farmland and rural towns in two. In the death strip between two 3-meter walls, guards and automatic devices fired at anyone who tried to escape. It was the embodiment of the phrase, Iron Curtain.
By 1989, the wall had been in place so long that most Europeans on both sides had never even seen its harsh details, much less thought about what would happen to East and West Germany if the wall came down, or what the end of the wall might mean for global politics. Welcome to the fall of the Berlin Wall, from German unification to a new world order. Joining us are several of the key political players whose decisions shaped history from the moment the wall was open. The mayor of Berlin at the moment the wall came down was Walter Momper. It fell to him to make immediate decisions, concrete decisions, about everything from whether to reopen streets and trains to East Berlin to what to do about police and emergency services for the people of the East. West Germany's foreign minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher confronted bigger picture questions. Should East and West Germany be politically unified? What would happen to political relations with the U.S., Britain, France, and with the Soviet Union? And Brent Scowcroft, national security advisor in the White House of then U.S. President George Herbert Walker Bush, had to decide whether and how quickly to embrace the sudden new realities of Europe and how to handle the Soviets. Offering a more contemporary perspective, Johannes Bonin of the Atlantic Initiative, an alumni of the BMW Foundation, will help us look back through the eyes of younger people for whom the Berlin Wall is, well, history. And to help us connect with our studio audience a bit later in the program, Max Hoffman of Deutsche Welle Television. We have a studio audience of students from Georgetown University and the German School here in Washington, along with Germany's ambassador to the United States and other followers of transatlantic affairs, including officials of a Cold War radio station called RIAS, Radio in the American Sector, which once breached the wall with information from the West. But first, let's take a quick walk through the rapid-fire events that unfolded exactly 20 years ago, when the Berlin Wall fell.
On the eve of the 2nd of October, 1990, crowds gathered in Berlin to celebrate the formal end of a divided Germany. Less than a year and a half earlier, few could even have imagined that the wall would have come down. This cut marked the beginning of the end of the Iron Curtain. On May 2, 1989, Hungarian border guards began to dismantle the barbed wire fence at Hungary's frontier with Austria. Initially, the opening to the West was restricted to Hungarians. But that summer, thousands of East Germans traveled to Hungary, desperate to reach the West, whatever it took. On the 11th of September, Hungarian Foreign Minister Horn announced on state television that the border to Austria was open, also for East German citizens. 3 weeks later in Czechoslovakia, thousands of East Germans had taken refuge in Bonn's embassy in Prague, waiting to hear West German Foreign Minister Genscher.
Ihre Ausreise.
The rest of Genscher's words were drowned out in screams of jubilation. At the same time in East Germany, the street protests against the regime were growing. In Leipzig, some 70,000 people took to the streets in what was seen as a critical showdown. The authorities backed off, and the rally ended peacefully. A few weeks later, as many as 500,000 people joined mass protests all over the country. On the 9th of November, the world was taken by surprise by an announcement on East German state television implying that the wall was open immediately. Thousands of East Germans thronged the border crossings. Soon they were unstoppable. The next day, West Berlin Mayor Walter Momper expressed the feelings of Germans both in the East and West.
Wir Deutschen sind jetzt das glücklichste Volk auf der Welt.
The wall that had divided the country for decades was suddenly the symbol of a nation's joy. A few months later, on March 18, 1990, East Germans went to the polls in their first free legislative elections. But it was becoming increasingly clear that the so-called German Democratic Republic could not survive on its own. The East Germans wanted Western currency, and they wanted a united Germany. At midnight on October 3, 1990, East and West Germans celebrated the unification of their countries. And that day is now a national holiday.
Walter Momper, you looked a little younger back in that video clip a minute ago, but tell me a little bit, when you heard the announcement, first of all, how did you hear the announcement, and what was your feeling right at that moment?
Well, you see, we had an announcement before at the end of October. We had a meeting with Schabowski, and he said we would give freedom of traveling. For us, it was quite clear since September, October 1989, that there would come a storm over the wall from behind, as we put it, because it was funny for the people that they could go over Prague and over Budapest and so, but couldn't go directly to West Berlin. And it was obvious that they would end that one day. So that evening, we had this 10 days, we didn't knew that it was 10 days, to prepare everything together with the GDR, together with Schabowski, the opening of new crossing points and things like that, and how to organize the traffic. And he has told us, we had asked him and said, well, tell us before, when will you do it? You were giving freedom of traveling, as he said. And when will you do it? Oh, we'll do it before Christmas, he said. And we said, well, tell us before, a week or 2 weeks or 4 days, but tell us before. And that evening I was in the Springer house, in the publisher's house, and the publisher of the Berliner Morgenpost, one of the papers, came, and he said, well, have you heard about Schabowski's press conference? And he said, well, he has talked about freedom of traveling and so on, new regulations. And he asked me to come to look at on the video, which just the last 5 minutes was a long press conference, 2 hours or so, about who comes into the Politburo, who gets out, what they will change in the party, and so on. And at the very end, he took this sheet of paper, reads it for the first time.
Pretty mechanical, too. He didn't have
any emotion in it. Pretty mechanically. Now we know that at the end of the party conference, Krenz, the number one, gave him the sheet of paper and said, oh, I think that is important, read it tonight in the press conference. But then he has forgotten to read it, and he hasn't heard it because he was not in when they had it on the party conference, so he completely didn't knew what was in it. And he himself later on told me that he says, well, at the very end of the press conference, I remember there was a paper from Krenz, and he took it, and then he was reading it. Then they asked him, one journalist asked, when will that work? And he looked and said, well, at once, now, right now. And then he was asked, will it work for West Berlin? And he says, yeah, all crossing points of the GDR to foreign countries, so that means West Berlin as well. And then the press conference was over, and there was not, you know, it was not the first regulations on traveling, one must say. There was another one some 4 or 5 days before. And when I heard that, then they called me from Rathaus Schöneberg, where the chancellery of the governing mayor was. They had seen it a second time. And then we said, well, that's the situation now. That's what he has told us before. And I thought, why didn't he told us before? He had promised that. And then we thought to bring a little bit, you know, dynamics into it, to cut him off the way back. I mean, otherwise he would have said half an hour later, 2 hours later, it was all an error. He has got the wrong paper or so. Then I went to our local TV station and made an interpretation of that in a way. They showed Schabowski with the regulation, and they asked me, and I said, well, we are happy that all East Berliners and East Germans now can come, and we will welcome them, and it's a great thing for us, and a historic moment, and the day we have waited for 28 years, 1961. And then at the very end of that, always thinking about the practical things, I said, well, everybody is welcome who will come, but you must know if you can come now, you can come in 4 days or 4 weeks or 4 months. So don't come all the very first day where it's possible. And then I said, thinking of the transport problem, I said, well, come and look on the Kudamm, how it looks like and how West Berlin looks like. But if you come, leave the Trabis and the Wartburgs at home and come by public transport, by underground and S-Bahn. And later on people have told me that they have heard it. They didn't understand Schabowski because that was bureaucratic. Then me talking about historic days and historic hours, but all these days and hours were historic, so it was nothing special. But then at the very end, you can come and you are welcome, but leave the Trabis and the Wartburgs at home. Then they went to the border and discussed there how they could go over.
Let me ask former German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher, where were you when that announcement was made? Did you believe it when you first heard it? And did you go to a border crossing of some sort?
No, I was with Federal Chancellor Kohl for an official visit in Warsaw. And during the state's dinner, we heard the war is open. You will understand it became the shortest dinner I ever had in my life. And
excuse me, Mr. Chancellor, I have to go.
No. We both had to excuse ourselves to the Polish government because we returned to the guest house of the Polish government. And the first decision was, in this moment, we have to go to Berlin next morning. And what was remarkable is that next morning, before we left Warsaw, I had a meeting with Lech Walesa. He was candidate for Polish presidency, and he was accompanied by Bronislaw Geremek, his diplomatic advisor, later for many years, Polish foreign minister.
He was the solidarity leader in Poland.
Yes, he was one, the most important leader behind Walesa. And Geremek said, and this was, I think, a historical remark, he said, the fall of the wall, that means Germany will be united.
Really, on the second day, he said that
already. The second day. This is a great day for Germany, at the same time is a great day for Poland. Because when Germany is united, Poland is neighbor of NATO and European Union. Today they are member of both. That shows that this event in Germany was not restricted in its effect on Germany alone. It was a European, it was a world event because more or less it meant the beginning of the end of the Cold War.
Did you believe any of that in the first moments after
I believed it because we had hoped it so often, so I was happy I could believe it.
Okay. Johannes Bonin, you were a young man at the time, and you were observing it from afar a bit, but with German heritage, obviously. Did you believe this would ever happen in Germany? What was your feeling on that day?
Well, I didn't believe it, but I hoped for it. I remember I was 24 years old at the time. I was a student of Bonn University, and I was meeting with friends of mine. We had a political discussion group, and we talked about perestroika, glasnost, and Germany's role in that. And one of us said...
But all that was going on in Russia. That was all going on in the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was 8 o'clock, and somebody said, why don't we switch on the television, watch what's going on in the news. And we saw these people standing on the wall, and we just couldn't believe it. And three of us said, you know, let's hit the road, let's drive to Berlin immediately and see what's going on and be part of it. And to the very day, I regret that I didn't go because I had a very important exam 2 days after.
We'll have to tell your professor about that. Let's cross the Atlantic for a second. Brent Scowcroft, you were sitting in the White House perhaps when
yes.
you heard the announcement. Did you believe it?
We weren't sure what to think because the mayor has described the situation. It was confusing right on the scene, and we didn't know. We had heard the report that the wall was open, but it might not include Berlin. We were debating what to do, and Marlon Fitzwater came in and said, the press is in a fury. You have to give a press conference.
Fitzwater was the press spokesman for the president at the
That's
time.
That's right. And so we sat with the president and said, look, we don't really know what the situation is. We don't know whether the wall is open or not. Whether it will stay open, we don't know what the reaction of the Russians will be. Be cautious, be noncommittal, which was his inclination anyway. So they invited the press into the Oval Office and they surrounded the president at his desk, and he described the events. And one of the reporters said, well, Mr. President, you don't seem very joyous. I would think you would want to be up dancing on the wall. And he says, well, I'm not an emotional kind of guy. But what he was trying to say is, you know, be careful. You know, this is a victory for everybody. We don't want it to look like a victory over the Soviet Union and thus put pressure on Gorbachev or on the Russians to respond the way they had in events since 1953.
In that connection, you're the behind-the-scenes guy in that situation. The president is obviously out in front making the policy, but you're behind the scenes. Did you pick up the phone and call the Kremlin and say, what the heck is going on here?
No.
You did not do that?
No, we did not.
Did you do it, Hans-Dietrich Genscher? Did you call the Soviets at all or make any contact with the Soviets to ask if this was
really
true?
No, but we received a cable from Gorbachev. What's going on?
Wait a minute, asked you?
Because, yes, the Chancellor received this question, and I completely understood, because Gorbachev was interested not only depend on the information given by the Red Army, because he was not interested that from these demonstrations in Berlin and the opening of the wall will have a bad impact on East-West relations. So I think it was wise that he tried to have a contact with Federal Chancellor, and he told him everything will go peacefully. We had this demonstration in front of the Schöneberger Rathaus, and it was absolutely clear people were happy, but no one was in favor of using force or something against the Russian troops. On the contrary, if you look what happened with the frontier groups of the GDR, people were happy the wall was open without any use of force of both sides. This is remarkable.
Just let me get this straight. On the moment the wall was opened, the Soviet Union called you, Germany, and said, what's going on?
No, they are informed what's going on, but their interest was, is the Federal Republic convinced that will be a peaceful development, or if it will come to use a force?
Okay.
And I think it was reasonable to behave in this way.
Brent, did you get
the
contact?
The president did talk to Gorbachev in the next day or so.
Yeah.
And
this was the next day, by the way.
That was the next day, and Gorbachev called, and essentially, you know, what is going on?
Yeah.
And it was an attempt at a reassuring conversation, and Gorbachev was alarmed. And I think this represented a sort of a fundamental change in his position, because during the earlier events of 1989, he had been relatively sympathetic to the liberalizing governments in Poland and in Hungary. Indeed, he encouraged the Communist Party in Poland to join the first non-communist government in the summer. So he saw these people as little Gorbachevs, and he was sort of sympathetic. But I think the fall of the wall changed his perspective some. He became alarmed that things were getting out of hand.
So all of these people are people who would normally want to be very much in control of events, very much forecasting events, but on that day it's clear people were not informed and not in control. It seemed perfectly natural at that time for Germans to be much more concerned about their own lives, about the politics and economics of East and West Germany, than about politics and global strategy. But for Washington and Moscow, and especially for London, Paris, and other major European players, the fall of the wall was a geopolitical earthquake. At the top of the agenda was an enormous political question. Should East and West Germany be reunified after decades of separation?
After the wall came down, the pundits on American news shows discussed the possibility of a German reunification. However, the timeline was far off.
I don't believe that unification is decades away. I really believe it will happen in the next decade, and maybe even within the next 5 years, surely within the next decade.
There seemed to be too many obstacles, but the 2+4 negotiations, an intense round of talks between the two Germanies and the four Allied powers, began in May 1990. Decidedly different interests had to be brought together, with President Bush being the strongest supporter of Kohl's vision.
The Brits were concerned about Germany becoming a dominant power again and making the European Union even more dominant, which Mrs. Thatcher, of course, feared greatly. They also feared that Germany would united Germany would dilute NATO and dilute the British role in NATO. So they were concerned. The French were concerned that this new Germany wouldn't be European enough, so a very different kind of concern. The Poles were concerned about the border issue, of course.
Securing U.S. support, Germany assured pro-NATO and pro-European engagement.
The German unification is only thinkable for us and for me, parallel to the European unification. That should deeply satisfy every American. We don't want to go back to the nation state of the 19th century. It is almost the year 2000. We want the political unification of Europe and the German unification.
Soviet leader Gorbachev, at the end, agreed to the terms, although Moscow delayed the ratification of the 2+4 contract.
But it was essentially a decision that had to be made between the Soviet Union and Germany with American support. Now, if the U.S. had not supported it, the question is, what would Germany have done at that point? It would have been a difficult issue for Germany. In the end, what happened on the international level is what the Germans did on the domestic level. Instead of creating in Germany, for example, a new constitution, they just took, I think it was Article 23, just accept the new lender from the East into the old system. And that's pretty much what the West did in terms of the security system as well, the alliance system. Don't create a new security system, simply extend the old one.
Against early predictions, the 2+4 treaty was signed in September 1990 and paved the way for the reunification.
So there's the thing. In some ways, German unification was something the Germans had looked for and imagined for a very, very long time, but others in Europe saw it as a specter that wasn't necessarily a positive thing. Johannes, were you even thinking as a young student at the time about reunifying East and West Germany?
Certainly not in the first moment, but I don't want to portray myself as the big visionary now. I was running a student journal at the time, and our next issue was out in December, mid-December. And I was writing this article that unification would come about, that I would be certain at the end of the next year.
You were doing that before the wall came down?
No, already? After. So the after. 9th of November, and I wrote this article in the mid of December. And the only question was, I wrote whether it would come about peacefully. And you know, there were the free elections on March 18th next year, and everything went pretty smooth. And I think the 10-point program by Helmut Kohl, where he really pressured the issue, was very instrumental, very important in that respect.
And were you thinking at all about the views of, let's say, Britain and France or other allies about that? Or
oh, yeah, absolutely. I also mentioned this the different diverging views in that article, because the Italians, the British, the French, they all had their reservations. And we can be extremely thankful that the Americans backed us that much. I mean, I think I recall in this wonderful book by Rice and Zelikow, Germany Unified, Europe Transformed, which reads like a thriller, that Bush offered to Chancellor Kohl already, I think, in September to talk about unification. And he said, no, this is not the time to do it. And
Walter Mompert, you were the mayor of West Berlin. Did you envision yourself all of a sudden as mayor of all Berlin, unified Berlin?
No. You see, you must know that the oppositional movement within the GDR, that they wanted to restructure the GDR to make it a more democratic, liberal, and social country than even West Germany was. That was so in October, November, December. That changed at the end of December and January, when the majority of the people in the GDR wanted to have unity. That is when Chancellor Kohl made his big rally in Dresden in, what was it, December 22nd. It became quite obvious that the people there wanted to have unity, that they want to have an end of SED, of Communist Party majority, that they want to have an end of Stasi, that they want to have Deutschmarks and be equal with regard to economy and so. And that changed very rapidly. I mean, the whole development accelerated from day to day. And if one would have said on November 9th or November 10th, we'll have German unity within less than 1 year, nobody would have believed that. Mm-hmm. If you look on the first proposal of the new government, the democratic government in GDR of the de Maizière government, it was a proposal for 4 years. 4 years.
Drawn-out process.
Yeah, and it came much quicker than we all expected it.
Hans-Dietrich Genscher, my recollection of the time is that you were a bit cautious about this. Of course, you had always talked about German unification, but...
I meant it.
You meant unification.
I meant it, yes.
But you were concerned about the British response, the Soviet response, the NATO-allied response. Why were you concerned about that at the time?
Why not go full steam ahead? I was not concerned. We had to convince them that their commitments made years and years before should now be fulfilled. And it's not true that President Mitterrand was totally against German unification. For Mitterrand, it was clear Germany had to be unified. But for him, it was important if the unified Germany will follow the same European line that the Federal Republic before unification had, or will Germany go the old ways? This was his question to me. So he was not against in substance, he was concerned what Germany will do with the unified country.
What do you mean by the old ways? That's code language.
This is the ways of centuries ago. When we had rivalry policies all over Europe. And now we are united in Europe, and will Germany stay in Europe? And I understood also concern with Germany stay in NATO. Yes, we said, I made a clear speech on the 31st of January 1990, where I said we will stay forever in the European Union and in NATO. This was crucial for the stability in Europe. What I could not understand was the position taken by Margaret Thatcher, because she was
the British Prime Minister at
the
time.
She was against unification, but she every year her foreign minister supported the resolution of NATO that we will fulfill our obligation to unite Germany.
But they didn't
and
believe it.
Look back to the year 1967. The NATO decided on the so-called Hamel Report, which developed a new political strategy for NATO, and there was stated that German division is the most important obstacle against stability in Europe. That meant when Germany is united, stability is guaranteed. This was exactly the right decision. And this, therefore, it was so important to understand German unification as part of European unification. She saw it, Mrs. Thatcher understood German unification in the sense of unification 100 years ago, but now it was part of the European unification. And what we had witnessed before was a peace revolution all over Eastern Europe. It was not only in GDR, it was in Poland, it was the Czech Republic, it was in Hungary, very different in substance. but with the same goal, self-determination, democracy, human dignity, market economy. These were the objectives of the people in the streets.
In a moment, we're going to come to our studio audience to ask you for some of your comments, but let me ask Brent Scowcroft. You had to navigate a sort of interesting ship at that point. Mm-hmm. Britain, obviously a very strong ally of the United States, France also a strong ally of the U.S., but of course Germany as well. The U.S. had to kind of decide, do we go full tilt in favor of quick German unification? What was your feeling at that time?
In Washington, we had something of an internal debate as well.
That's code language, too.
Which has been described. And I personally was very cautious for all the reasons that have been described. Everybody, every year, NATO passed a resolution in favor of Germany. Then all of a sudden it happened, and what do we do now? And there were concerns about the Soviet reaction.
Commit what never will happen.
Yes. Oh, yes. It was just
easy
ritual.
To say yes for something that wasn't on the horizon.
Ritual. There were concerns about our European allies, about the Russians, and even about Germans, because we were getting different opinions. You know, generally supporting unification, but at what rate, at what
pace,
could we tolerate? I was more cautious than Secretary of State Baker, who wanted to be out in front. And I didn't think the United States ought to get in front of the Germans, at least. The president was very noncommittal on all this until a NATO meeting in December. And the president had asked for a NATO meeting so he could report on the Malta summit with Gorbachev. And the night before that NATO meeting, he and Chancellor Kohl had dinner. And Chancellor Kohl laid out a plan for unification. And the president sat there and listened to it, and he said, I'm for it. Go for it. Just like that.
Were you annoyed, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, at the U.S. kind of not jumping right on the bandwagon immediately? Did that annoy the German government?
No. I was convinced that the United States would stick to their obligations, and they did. And I think being here 20 years after the fall of the wall, I really feel obliged to say how much gratitude we owe to the United States for supporting West Germany and West Berlin in the time of division of Germany, and for supporting us during the 2+4 negotiations. It happened 3 times. That Shevardnadze said when we had bilateral meetings.
He was the Soviet foreign minister at the time.
Is this also the position of Washington? And they could say yes, then it was okay. So I think Moscow had made a clear decision. They, for them, America was in global strategy the partner, and Germany was the partner for Europe. And though they were interested to keep control over the process, but finally Gorbachev had recognized Germany should be united.
Let me switch now to Max Hoffman, my colleague with the audience. Let's see what some other people here have to say or ask.
Thanks, Ralph. Of course, we have a lot of students here today of the German School in Washington, and I would just like to ask the principal of the German School here today, Mr. Gries. I'm sure you have a question.
Yes, of course I got a question. I would like to use the chance to ask Mr. Bumper. And Mr. Bumper, you as the ruling mayor of Berlin, what were your personal feelings on the very evening of the 9th of November?
You see, the feeling all these months, starting in August or in September, when so many hundreds of GDR people flew via Hungary to Austria, was how could it happen with a storm over the wall from behind, as we put it. That it would come was quite obvious. But we talked with the allies and, you know, with the security authorities. How could it happen? What can we do if it comes? And we only could think of it as we knew that if you have 700, 800 people who would try to climb over the wall at Brandenburg Gate, that would be all right. You had to have that number. Then there would be an enormous shooting, You know, the border guards would shoot. I mean, you never should forget that in February 1989, the last man, Chris Gaffroy, was shot down at the wall when he tried to escape from East Berlin. So an enormous bloodshed, you know, many people dead, blood and all. And what can we do? We can do really nothing because we were not allowed, and the Allies never went into the eastern sector in order to do something there. So the feeling was fear of the bloodshed, fear of the shooting, fear of violence. And if there would be violence once, there would be, you know, other violent situations following. So that very evening, my first thought was, my first thought really was, why didn't have Schabowski us not told before? And the second thought was, what has to be done to that it keeps peaceful, or that it goes on peaceful? And the greatest gift in that night, of course, it was all peaceful. I went to the crossing point in Walidenstraße, one of the crossing points, at about 11. From 8 on, people went to the border and discussed with the border guards what is going on. And Schabowski has said, we can go. And the border guard said, do you have a visum? If you have no visum, you can't go. And so 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people were there behind the crossing points. And at 11 o'clock, Bornholmer Straße was open, one of the crossing points. And so I went to the next one. I was to from the TV station that was in Walidenstraße, and there were 10,000 people in this before, behind, and within the crossing point. And the funny situation was that the border guards looked on the papers, if you showed them and make their stamps, amidst these thousands of people as if nothing has happened. It was a funny situation. And then I asked them what has gone on here. And after 2 or 3 hours, it was quite obvious that it was all calm. No one was shooting. No one was losing his nerves. And it was a peaceful process. And I think that's the biggest gift the Germans could have.
As you can see, for many on our panel, the fall of the wall might seem like yesterday, but as we found out for some of our audience, it seems really far away. So it's important to us to have the opinions and the views of young people on the streets, and what better places to ask them than here in the capital, Washington, D.C. of the United States, and of course the place where it all happened. So we also went to Berlin in Germany to ask there. And we're here in the heart of Berlin, obviously in front of Berlin's most famous monument, the Brandenburg Gate. And I'm with Tico, Janine, Christina, and Robert, all students of the Hertie School of Governance. They're all in their 20s, and I brought a couple of pictures to find out what they think about Germany, about the transatlantic relationship, and about the fall of the wall. We'll start out with our first picture, which is, of course, the Brandenburg Gate. Do you remember anything at all? You were 4, 5, 6 years old.
I remember when it first came up in the news and when my parents were watching it, and I was like 6 years old. And I remember that they were very emotional, and my mom cried and she told me, well, now a new period of my life starts. And when you were like 6 years old, this touches you.
It was a lot of euphoria, and yeah, it's I'm very emotional when I see this.
We're here on the National Mall in Washington to ask young students from the Georgetown University what they know about the fall of the wall and its impacts on global policies. John, can you tell us what young Americans today know about the fall of the wall? Do they know about the fall of the wall?
I would say most kids know the impact it had as far as foreign policy in the Soviet Union, and especially through things like President Reagan's speech at the wall. They knew it through that context.
Jessica, tell me, how did American react to the unification of Germany?
Well, obviously, with the fall of the wall, it was, I think, in a lot of American news media portrayed as the, you know, a democracy prevailing as opposed to the fall of communism.
Back in 89, François Mitterrand and Maggie Thatcher, they were not comfortable with Germany reuniting. They were afraid it was going to build up again, was going to be a dangerous country again. Is that, from your point of view today, imaginable at all?
I mean, I personally see the point that people might have been afraid about Germany getting dangerous again. But for me, from this perspective we're having now, I can't understand this risk back in person as myself.
What was America's position towards unification of Germany?
I think America was pro-German reunification. Why?
I think a reunified Germany posed to be a good trading partner.
Derek, this shows soldiers. They have a German flag on their shoulder badge.
I would say these are German soldiers in Afghanistan. That means that Germany plays a very important role in the fight against terrorism in Afghanistan.
The relationship between the U.S. and Germany have not been as good as they could have been lately.
But how important is Germany for America? What do you think?
Well, I think in the long run, I personally would like to be not Germany, but Europe to be the important partner of America. And of course, Germany is one of the largest and economic power of the European Union, then has an important stand.
Thank you very much for being with us today. It seems like the young generation in Germany feels much more European than it would have 20 years ago when the wall came down. And that's it from Berlin today.
Coming back to our panel here in Washington, let's talk for a moment about the implications of unified Germany, not only for Europe, but for the rest of the world. Hans-Dietrich Genscher, first of all, why were some people reluctant or at least wanted to see a slower progress toward unification? Were people afraid that a unified Germany would become a major military power again in Europe, perhaps even a power with nuclear weapons?
Maybe this was true, but the 2+4 treaty stated that Germany never will have nuclear weapons. We are the only country which committed itself in a treaty, an international treaty, not to have nuclear weapons. So there was no reason for that. I think this was some kind of old thinking, not understanding what was going on. It was a European, East European freedom revolution what happened. We had revolutions in 53 in GDR, 7 June 53. In 1956 in Hungary, in 68 in Czechoslovakia. We had Solidarność in Poland, but separated, one time in Germany, one time in Poland. Everything was totally different in 1989. All over the Soviet-occupied party of Central and Southeastern Europe were a peaceful revolution. And this was not understood by some people in the West. You could not separate German unification from European unification. It was for good reason. I mentioned what Bronislav Geremek stated the day after the war was over. He had understood this was not a German event, this was a European event. It was made progress to a better Europe as we had before in the time of the Cold War. And this made Europe more stable as we know now.
Brent Scowcroft, that kind of prediction about a European unification, not just a German unification, is exactly what had the Soviets a little worried about unified Germany being part of NATO. Mm-hmm. Here we are sitting 20 years later, and it looks so obvious. Of course, Germany should be part of NATO. At the time, it wasn't so obvious, was it?
No, it was a substantial debate. And Gorbachev was reluctant is an understatement,
right.
and he was the most liberal of the Politburo. But when it came right down to it, a unified Germany not in NATO was not attractive to him either. And so he didn't have a better alternative. And there was one occasion, he was in a visit to Washington, and
this was in May.
This was in May.
Yeah.
And we had a debate about this, and he would just wouldn't answer. And so President Bush turned to him and said, would you agree that Germany has the right to choose what alliances it will or will not be in? And he said, yes. And there was an uproar on the Soviet side of the table. And they called a halt to the meeting, and they caucused and so on. And they sat back down, President Bush asked the question again, and President Gorbachev tried to back away, and he said, I think we should turn this discussion over to our foreign ministers. And Shevardnadze said, oh, no. oh no, this can only be discussed by the heads of state. So in the end, that was what broke the ice. In the end, he didn't have a better alternative. And for him, the idea of a unified, neutral Germany, loose in Europe between East and West, was not attractive.
Let me pursue that just a bit.
May I make some additional remark? When we negotiated the final act of Helsinki, it was the German government that insisted that there was one phrase saying that all the signature states have the right to decide that they will join a defense alliance. We did so because of the perspective of a possible German unification. We had two points important for German unification. The one was United Germany can join NATO. And the other one was peaceful change of borders is possible, because to neglect the border between East and West Germany, unification of Germany, was also a change of borders. So a peaceful change is possible. And this was very problematic for the Russian delegation. Der Pomyko said to me, that never will be agreed by the Soviet Union. And finally they gave in because they were interested to have the final act. So I think it was really important that from the beginning, German policy, whoever was in the government, which party was in government, the objective of German unification was one of the main objective of our policy.
Walter Mumper, you had to deal with that border right in your own backyard, front yard actually, your comments.
I mean, we were far away from Poland, the Baltic states, and so being members of NATO and of European Union. I mean, the discussion of that time of 1990 was, could there be a reunited Germany being in the NATO with NATO troops on the territories and all that? And if someone would have said in these days that within 20 years, Poland, Baltic states, Bulgaria and so on would be members of European Union, and of members of NATO, everybody would have said, oh, that's a process of 100 years or something like that. But it came, all the development after that was as quick as the whole development between November 9th and German unity to now.
Just because I think it's important to nail this down, I think you've all portrayed unified Germany and NATO as something especially objectionable to the Soviet Union at the time and to Russia. But others were not so happy about the idea of a floating, unified Germany. I don't think the NATO allies would have been all that happy either, right, Brent Scowcroft?
I think that's true.
The idea of Germany being tethered to an alliance with rules and with consensus and so on was very important to the West as well as to the Soviets.
I think that's true. A Germany embedded in a broader Europe and in an Atlantic alliance was...
We'll be surprised, but Germany also was very happy to be embedded in the alliance.
I think that was the most important thing Chancellor Kohl and the federal government did, that they, and together with Mitterrand, that they were combined within Europe, more important Europe and a stronger Europe, and the Germans were in there. Even from our German point of view, I mean, I do not want the situation of the national states of... National state Germany 1980 or 1920 or whatsoever.
That was a very important point. Chancellor Kohl demonstrated to everyone he was a sincere European.
Yes,
that was
there was
important.
No doubt about that.
And that was
key to it.
Let me focus back on the wall for just a moment, because one of the ironies of the fall of the Berlin Wall 20 years later is that since 1989, additional new political walls have been built around the world, and others have remained in place.
Since 1953, a demilitarized zone has separated North and South Korea. To this day, the communist rulers in the north of the peninsula threaten the democratically governed South. Both states are still officially at war with each other. But by now, the separation of the country is considered normal.
We, the younger generation, are not that interested in reunification. In fact, it's no big deal. We are more concerned about global problems, but the older generation looks at that differently.
South Korean visitors hang photos, letters, and pieces of cloth on the fence. The Iron Curtain is a symbol of inhumanity. People in Cyprus also live separated from each other. In 1974, war divided the island into a Greek south and a Turkish north. Since then, the border has become more open. It still exists in people's minds, however, according to Heidi Trautmann, who organizes art exhibitions on both sides.
I believe that people on both sides, due to their individual upbringing, are just not willing to meet in the middle and to allow each other personal freedom and civil liberty.
A wall divides also in Israel. This barrier separates Jewish Israel from the Islamic West Bank. There, conflict has been going on for decades. Israeli peace activists regularly spray paint their messages on the concrete slabs.
The whole idea behind it was just to get people to know. We will not push them to support or to say something about the wall. No, no, no. The only thing that we want them to do is to know.
With this wall, both sides have grown farther apart from each other. The concrete wall divides a country which both Palestinians and Israelis consider their homeland.
We are simple farmers. We need our land. We don't want conflict or war, but this occupation and these settlements have to stop.
The border fence separating the United States from Mexico is about 900 miles long. It is supposed to keep people from Mexico from illegally entering the U.S.
The point of these fences is really to be like a deterrent to people that physically can't make it over, and then also for people that, even though they know they can make it over, it slows them down enough where our camera systems will pick them up, and then us agents will be able to get in there, react to the situation, and make an arrest.
That's how Americans see it. In Mexico, many people consider the metal fence a provocation, a barrier between the rich and the poor.
Well, they want to go across because it's difficult right now over here, so they'll do whatever it takes to get across it. They get caught, they're going to go back again and again until they make it.
The Berlin Wall came down. Is this an isolated case in history or an example that other walls can be brought down as well?
Brent Scowcroft, back in 20 years ago, 1989, would you have imagined that the United States would be among the countries in the world to build a new wall since the end of the Berlin Wall?
No, I wouldn't have. But I think there are walls and there are walls. And this is a special case. Remember in 1961 why the wall went up? It may have prevented a conflict because there was an exodus into West Germany there. And one can argue that putting the wall up stopped the problem from getting worse. It also may have extended the Cold War. Who knows? But each one of these circumstances is different. I think in general, walls are harmful. In the short run, they may prevent conflict.
It also raises the question, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, of the actual role of the particular wall involved. In the case of the Berlin Wall, although they made the argument it was to prevent a Western invasion of the Soviet alliance, we all know that the reality was it was to keep Easterners in. But today, some of the other walls are designed to keep people out. What would be your prescription for, let's say, North and South Korea, or for the Israelis and the Palestinians?
I think the time of globalization will not tolerate walls forever. But I have to reject the idea that the building of the wall was to defend the German Democratic Republic. This was a result of a competition between the Western system and the communist system. And the communist leadership realized they had lost this competition. People left GDR because they preferred to live in the West, though they stopped this development. But this, one cannot argue this was not necessary to avoid the conflict. This was a very peaceful movement, and this was stopped. And I personally was convinced this will not last forever. In spring 1989, Honecker stated in the fair in Leipzig, even in 100 years, war will still exist.
Eric was the
best,
was the
this was the best joke of the history of GDR ever made. So I think we should not in any way try to explain why there was a need to build this wall. This wall was brutal. People were killed at the wall. This is the reality of that wall. And it was brought down, maybe by chance, on the 9th of 11. But I think later, in very short time, it would be opened without this chance situation on the 9th with the man who was not well informed, as Mamba explained to us.
Let's turn back to our studio audience again. Max Hoffman.
All right. We asked our the users of our webpage before the show if they had any questions. You can check it out at www.w-world.de. And Olga from Russia wants to know from Mr. Scowcroft, if you had to do it all again from the American perspective, is there anything you would do differently?
I think basically not. There were things that perhaps could have been done more smoothly. But I think under the circumstance, one of the things we haven't mentioned in this group is how fast events were happening in East Germany. They were really pulling us along. We were catching up with events in East Germany. And I think given that, there was a certain amount of improvisation, and perhaps if we had had more time to deliberate, we could have created earlier a better architecture for a Europe in general, but I'm quite content with the way it came out.
My name is Robert Grathwall, and Hans-Dietrich Genscher mentioned the Helsinki Accords, which put an emphasis on human rights and had an impact throughout Eastern Europe. What role did they play in the fall of the wall?
This Helsinki Final Act was a basis for the discussions initiated by the people in the east of Europe. That was why we insisted that this final act should be published in newspapers all over Europe. And so people could refer, our government signed that there is freedom of movement, that it's possible that Western TV stations could report from the Soviet part of Europe. If you remember in 89, when the demonstration on the 9th of October took place in Leipzig, it was reported by the West German television via television to the whole GDR, so the people in Rostock and in Weimar got the information what happened in Leipzig. And they said we should do the same. And this was a very important impact on the development. I think that the final act of Helsinki, which initially came from as a proposal from the Soviet Union to fix the situation in Europe, was the starting point for a change in Europe. It's a remarkable success of Western policy.
You know, I know that we could talk about this for many, many hours, but I'm afraid the fall of the Berlin Wall, with all of its implications for Germany and for Europe, and for that matter, the Cold War, the U.S., and indeed all other countries, is something we'll be studying and talking about yet for years to come, I'm sure. On this 20th anniversary, the events of the 1989 period already seem quite distant, but the geopolitical ripple effects are still being felt and recalled, of course, in places as far away as the Korean Peninsula, the Middle East, even the Texas-Mexico border. I want to thank our special guests, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, former German foreign minister, Walter Momper, the former mayor of Berlin, Brent Scowcroft, former national security advisor in the George Bush number one administration, and Johannes Bonin, and my Deutsche Welle colleague Max Hoffman as well. Thanks also to all of you in our studio audience and to you for watching. I'm Ralph Begleiter in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much.